Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. Wow, are we going to have a conversation this evening? Do you enjoy science fiction? Do you enjoy programs like Star Trek, Star Wars, all kinds of different unique ways of thinking relative to the future? Well, if you are a person that is engaged in that, I think you're going to find our conversation is an interesting one. Actually, we're going to be talking about two books that are linked together. They are part of a series. Richard Anderson is my guest. He holds a master's degree in microbiology. He's been a clinical laboratory bioanalyst. And writing these books actually were very, very much a dream of his. And so he has completed two. The very first one, which we're going to talk about for a few minutes, is The Evolution of Life. The second one is Outbound, Islands in the Void. And I will tell you, it is something that is just out of this world, and pun is intended. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Richard, you started off this series with The Evolution of Life, Big Bang to Space Colonies. When I was going through and I was reading it, you go into a lot of science. And this is the precursor to this Outbound, Islands in the Void. Now, this is a very unique way of approaching what one might look at as a futuristic kind of an imagery. But yet, there is so much fact. I mean, these two books are extraordinarily interesting. Why did you choose to start out with information about the universe and all of the different aspects of knowledge that one might be surprised that someone that is involved in microbiology and is a clinical laboratory bioanalyst, why you wanted to do that first? What was it that pushed your imaginative buttons to go to work on this?
Well, it wasn't by grand design. I had been, interested in filling some gaps in my own knowledge in the evolution of life. And also I was a little bit frustrated with some of the misconceptions out in society in general and lack of understanding of evolution. So that was the motivation to start writing that book. Part of it was, a lot of it was for my own benefit, just to fill in some of these areas that I was unsure about. So I started researching that book actually before the COVID lockdown, so about 2019. I had no intention of writing a novel, but I wanted to show the coherence, the physical and biological coherence of the universe that led to us. And then, of course, I'm somewhat of a futurist, so I like to project and see what the future might hold for us. And so I came up with the title Big Bang to Space Colony. So that spans a time frame of about 13.8 billion years, which is kind of a broad time frame. But when I got to the end of the book and I started looking at space colonies, and I started doing a little bit of research on how some of the proposals for living in space, I found a lack in the information that was available on the biological aspects of living in space. There were a lot of technical papers and a lot of technical analysis and designs that would work, but there was very little information on how the biology would work, which would be absolutely necessary. We would have to carry our own ecosystems into space. We would have to duplicate Earth in a lot of ways to survive in space. So that was the impetus for me to start the novel series, Outbound, and I intend 3 books. So this book is Outbound, Islands in the Void, and it's post-climate apocalypse on Earth, about 250 years in the future. And I develop a lot of the stories on Earth and then in space and development of societies in space and how the resources of space could be used to assist Earth in its recovery. And there's a lot of politics and there's a lot of action in this book, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to make the story fun with still conveying some interesting ideas behind the action and behind this story. So, for example, in one scene, I have one of the heroes, one of the protagonists, flying with his family over the Amazon, and I describe the Amazon as an arid, very hot, unlivable place with sluggish mud-strewn river running out to polluting the Atlantic Ocean, South Atlantic Ocean, which is what it will become if the present trend of deforestation and burning the jungle continues. So I do try to describe some of the downsides of the future. But in 250 years in the novel, I have us projected on a recovery stance. So the apocalypse has already happened. And now we take this story. How do we solve the problem that's happened? How do we solve the issues with society? How do we solve the biological, the climate problems on Earth? And how do we survive in space? So it's a fun read, at least it was for me.
Well, what I found so intriguing is something that actually we're dealing with today, water ecology, and then cyanobacteria. Growth chambers. Yes. When I think of the sci-fi series Battlestar Galactica, that was on, I don't remember what the time frame was, if it was in the 1970s, I'm not sure. But the thing was that the Battlestar and whoever wrote the script, and I know they have a team of writers, they had to have their own farm on the ships. The ships had to be self-sustaining, and you bring that out. And that is something that's being worked with right now, like the closed-loop systems for waste disposal.
We don't
have Long Island areas where we can dump trash, thank you very much. Although that was in a Disney cartoon movie about a robot. I believe it was called One. And I could have the title wrong, but that's what I think it was called. It's this little robot that was on this planet where all the junk, space junk,
went. Yeah, I know the movie. That wasn't the name. It was,
I
can't think of the name, but I know the movie.
Right, but there was that tremendous projection in that movie, people living on a spaceship and being able, everybody was fat and happy. I remember that very vividly. And he was able to get one little plant. And the plants are so vital. They are so extremely vital, right along with the trees. All of the living essence that we have on this planet is extremely important. Self-sustaining ecosystems. And that is one of the biggest challenges with Mars. And you bring out this information, how it actually, as a planet, is not a very pleasant planet.
Oh, it's extremely hostile. Yeah.
So here we are with, there's so much fact that is woven through the fabrication, the fiction. I just thoroughly enjoyed this book. And the fact that there are all of these things that have to be considered. How do you create a gravitational environment on a planet that doesn't have it. Well, I think it was just last week I saw in some space show where there was this cylinder type of structure where a million people lived on it, and it was constantly rotating. It was creating its own gravitational field. And when I'm reading your book and I'm saying, gee, I think I just saw that last week, it just fascinated me, the synchronicity of various things that I have come across just in the past 2 weeks. And this is up on YouTube. And I thought, here are all of these people with this awareness of what we're evolving into. And that's what you are doing. It's just amazing.
The cylinder is called an O'Neill cylinder. It was invented or envisioned by Dr. O'Neill, who was a physicist in the 1970s, and he became interested in space habitats. And so he thought, how can you create the gravity? Well, centripetal force, you have to rotate. And so that's, if you remember the movie 2001, they had a double torso ring, which was the space station that was creating one gravity on the inner surface, sort of like a big rotating donut. And but O'Neill, my favorite was his cylinder that's like a Coors beer can that's 20 kilometers long and maybe 2 kilometers in diameter. And you create the environment inside of this rotating cylinder. And you create a part of an ecosystem, a complete ecosystem, but there are many different ecosystems on Earth. So you try to create different ones and different cylinders to preserve the species and to provide different. You have to remember, people will get bored very quickly if they're in the same environment all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You need to change. There's the sociological, psychological effect, so that they could move between cylinders in a cluster, and each one would be different, have different environments. And you might take a holiday weekend in a different cylinder than the one you live in. But the one gravity, the one that's called standard gravity, is important to our health, as they've proven on the space station. So you have to do that. And in the Mars book that I'm just finished and just, it'll be published shortly, that one, I create a method for generating one gravity on the surface of Mars, which only has 38% of Earth gravity. And we don't want to live in 38% gravity, because our whole bodies will atrophy. And I don't think anybody wants to live in that kind of a situation.
I agree. And when you think of something else, what was the movie? It was with Arnold Schwarzenegger. It was Recall.
Yes,
and that movie, there was the factor that without certain equipment operating, everyone would die on the planet.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I find that your story, with all of the scientific commentary that you have inside of it, all of this knowledge really is very much known by many, many researchers, including yourself, and they've got the dilemma, how do we enable, first of all, the very first colonists to go there? Because it's really going to be, in relative terms, very primitive. It's you learn as you go. If you survive, then that's wonderful. It's not unlike the pioneers that came out west, into the unknown.
It's a lot different than the pioneers that came out west. There are two differences. One is you had an existing ecosystem that they could hunt.
That's true.
They could, in the longer term, they could plant you know, they could plant crops, but yeah, mainly they carried the supplies with them, and then they could supplement that with hunting on the trip. You don't have that in outer space. You have no support system, so that's a major difficulty. So you can't build that civilization from Earth. You have to establish a toehold, and then start developing the capabilities to use the resources that are already in space. And in the book, we're out in the asteroid belt, developing materials there to send back to a manufacturing station that's in Earth orbit, and can send, you know, refined products and supplies to Earth, but also support itself. So it's a huge undertaking, and it's easy to think about and write about, but to implement, it's a major, very major effort.
Yes, it is. It's a huge effort because you don't have a 7-Eleven on every other asteroid. Thank you very much. So you have to be able to support the self. And you go into so much of technology that I think we've already have the brain power for, but it is the instrumentation and application in a real life scenario that is the big challenge. And it takes a while to get from planet Earth up to Mars. It's not something that happens in 25 minutes. And it is quite a challenge because, again, there's so much we don't know about that planet. But I was intrigued with the virtual sentient that you brought into the story that I thought was incredibly interesting.
Ophelia?
Yes, Ophelia, yes.
Have you finished the book?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so we won't talk about the ending.
That is correct. No, and the ending is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. So I won't, no. We won't give that away. But I found this advancement in technology because we are in, 2250? And
about that time frame, yeah.
Where we are with artificial intelligence and with computerization that is advancing at such a speed that most of us, we go, thank you very much, but I haven't figured out what I needed to know 2 years ago, much less trying to get ahead 250 years.
Well, I'm with you there.
So, you know, it's really amazing because you have to think of atmospheric conditions. You have to think about the atmosphere, how it affects someone physiologically, and what you do to keep people healthy. It really is, it's quite fascinating. And the fact that there is a communication capacity that is absolutely phenomenal. But now there's also the bad guys in this book. It is actually one man, and he's just awful. But he has such a love of power that he thinks he's going to be able to take over everything, not just on Earth, but also with the colonies that are being developed. And this is the information system, the way the military operates, because there's still military presence. And all of the different factors that go along with this, and they have their challenges, they have their problems. And then you also bring up Antarctica. Now, there is so much information coming out about Antarctica that it really is totally unexpected on the part of most people, because we've always thought of it as one gigantic ice floe.
Yeah.
Hey, that's what it is. You just, you know, that's the way it's always going to be. Well, that's not the way it's always going to be, because it used to be tropical. And
yeah, the continental drift. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So here we've got Antarctica, where there's resorts on Antarctica. And all of this futuristic, we're not talking about overnight, and maybe in the overall aspect of time, since there is no time and space, out in space, then you're talking about something that takes a long time to evolve. And by golly, you bring it all into perspective. It just is so intriguing. And we're seeing a lot of this even right now as we're chatting.
Yeah, and you know, one of the areas that I tried to develop a little bit in the story, and I'm carrying that into the Mars book a little bit more, is the social aspects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't have our act together as societies. We do have a lot of problems that would be fatal if they existed in space islands. You can't have a terrorist. You know, in fact, in these islands, in these rotating cylinders, I don't even allow open fires. People's dwellings don't have kitchens. They have central dining rooms and restaurants and so forth, where there's a whole science behind the food production. But you can't have smoke and different pollutants coming into the air, because you have a very closed system. And you need also monitors and things like that for, infectious viruses or contagions in the atmosphere, as well as pollutants and the means to remove those. On Earth, we have Earth is a huge place by comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So the social aspect, you have to provide an environment that is interesting and challenging and has enough variety to where people could be happy, and you need to fill all of their psychological needs as well as their biological needs, and that's a big call. That's a huge call for living in a hostile environment in space or on Mars or out in Ceres in the asteroid belt. I think I described the original colony out in Ceres, and these scientists are out there almost freezing.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yes.
They're living under very harsh conditions because they don't have a lot of energy they can waste on heat. They have minimal food production capabilities, so their diet is fairly boring, and they do take some steps to try to make things more interesting with little contests and cooking contests and things like that. But you have to consider the social aspect of this for a long-term society in space or, you know, away from Earth. There are a lot of issues that need to be addressed, and the social ones are probably the most important of those.
You talk in your book also about lava tubes, and we have them here on Earth, but your one sentence in your book is, it takes 132 years of hard work to develop the full extent of the lava tubes into a habitable and productive base that benefits from the continued creation of viable soil and increased purification of the water supply. Now, the lava tubes have been here on Earth for tens of thousands, if not millions of years, depending on when the eruptions occurred. And they're really quite fascinating. And to be able to create a habitat inside of those lava tubes on Mars is incredibly creative thinking, I believe.
Well, Olympus Mons is the largest volcano in the solar system. And Mars was geologically, active billions of years ago. And, much like Earth is. And so, yes, it did have eruptions. It did have, it did form lava tubes. And they're likely, a lot of them around Olympus Mons, underground. So I'm assuming that they're there. We establish, NASA establishes the base, and but they can't function well on the surface because of very strong ultraviolet radiation. There's cosmic radiation. The atmosphere is only 1% of what Earth's atmosphere is, so it doesn't screen out any of those harmful rays. And so it's best that you can only survive long term underground, being shielded from all that radiation. So they find the lava tubes and they start developing the lava tubes, and then they need to expand. So then they're digging more, and it's theorized, it hasn't been demonstrated yet, but it's theorized that there is internal heat on the planet Mars if you go deep enough. And these lava tubes would go presumably fairly deep. You could have liquid water deep down in these lava tubes, and it would have a very high salt content and selenium content, and it would be probably toxic. So it would have to be purified, but it's water to be used. So Mars probably has a lot of water, unlike the moon. Water is probably very scarce on the moon, but that's one of the encouraging things about Mars, is it does have a lot of water that could be used. And you just aren't going to live anywhere without a good water supply.
That's very true for we humans especially. Well, actually, for all forms of life that we have here. You have the mosquitoes, everything from mosquitoes to elephants. So we all have to have that, and we have to have the minerals and the other things as well. You talk about the aquatic life and how hydroponic food is being done. And I think about hydroponics, it's really nothing new in human history. We've just become what we think a sophisticated system that is fascinating, but it is something that even ancients used forms of hydroponic patternings that worked very well for them. It wasn't with all populations on the planet, but there were those that had figured it out, and they utilized what they developed. And it was quite interesting how effective that was, even in Egypt. So you have that, but the engineering of the plants, the mutations that they would need to go through to be able to survive, all of this is brought into the picture, and there is a primary character, Virgil. He has been given an assignment, and he doesn't feel like he has enough experience or knowledge. But two of the plants that are used that grow very, very well, bamboo and hemp, on all of the space islands, is exactly grown. And of course, bamboo has really been a favorite, product.
Sustainable.
Yes. It works very well. I mean, it's been used in Asia for thousands and thousands of years.
Well, it's very sustainable, and you cut it down and it grows back like, you know, in the next week. So to contain it is the issue. It's very prolific.
Yes, it is.
And it can be used. You can make hardwood floors from it. You can make countertops from it. You can make clothes out of it. And hemp has a lot of the same versatility, mainly for, making textiles, you know, clothes and things like that. So, yeah, those things are efficient and would work in space. You would not have cows. You wouldn't have, if you want beef, it's going to have to be manufactured, and that's possible. You might have a limited amount of seafood or fish, but not like we have, not plentiful like on Earth. Most of the food is going to be grown in tanks, and proteins produced by bioengineering and assembled into, Beyond Burgers and things like that. So, but the plant life and the hydroponics, like you say, hydroponics goes back to the Aztecs and the Incas in Mexico and Central America. They used water in the island, they use, well, it wasn't exactly hydroponics, but they used a tiered system where they dug, you know, in swampy areas, they dug channels around and made islands, artificial islands, dredged out around the island and piled the soil on top. And then they raised fish in the around in the water around the islands, and they grew crops on top. And they could use the fertilized water that the fish lived in to water the crops. It was a beautiful system, and it was very productive and very efficient. On Mars, the soil is absolutely toxic. You'd have to detoxify it to, it has like bleach in it. So it proteins and any organic chemicals or molecules will be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And any living thing would be destroyed by the contact with the soil. So you can't grow anything in that soil. You could detoxify it. But hydroponics, you don't need soil. You just need the water that has the minerals and the other nutrients and nitrogen and so forth incorporated, and then a source of light, you know, a source of energy for the plants.
I personally thoroughly enjoyed the section on food. I'm sort of a foodie anyway, and I delighted in the cutlery that you described that actually produced flavors.
And oh, yeah.
There's just all of this wondrous thought patterning, and I thought, you know what? That is something that would not surprise me at all, because there is so much that is done with flavorings, and it's been done for, again, thousands of years. But I had to smile when I saw the information about processed insects were used in many snack foods, such as energy bars, chips, crackers, and candy. Yeah, right. So all you need to know. Now, believe it or not, in the Asian countries, and I know this for a fact, and there's many cultures, like in Africa, that will eat insects. They'll eat the larva, they'll eat, you know, whatever. And, of course, those of us in the Western world, we sort of gag every time we see that.
Yeah.
But I know of someone here, and I didn't know them personally. I knew someone who was one of their neighbors, and this person was raising cockroaches. I don't know what species of cockroach that was to be made into chocolate candy.
Absolutely.
And well, I go, that's nice. Okay.
Well, there was a fad back in the 60s, I believe, you know, chocolate-covered grasshoppers and things
yes.
like that you could buy. But no, looking at it from a practical standpoint, insects are, in general, they're highly nutritious. They have good fats. They're high in protein. They just, and if you roast them, they're like snack food. And I just thought, well, yeah, if you toasted them and ground them up and you made energy bars, you know, but it'd be great. People didn't know what they were eating. So today they use insects, but not directly for human consumption. They feed, you know, fish and chickens and
snakes,
other
lizards. Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, in those situations, on Mars or in space, they would make absolute sense to raise insects as a protein, as a food source.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you just need those creative chefs. Well, there is so much in your book. There's just Outbound Islands in the Void, and then your other book, The Evolution of Life. So The Evolution of Life would be first, and then Outbound Islands in the Void. And then you've got number 3 that's going to be released. It really is quite a phenomenal read. I think sharing something like this with kids that are looking at, gee, what can I do when I grow up? We may have some children within, you know, the next couple of generations that it'll either be born in space or they're going to say, this is where I want to live. I want to live on Mars, or I want to live on the moon, or whatever is going on. because I really think
involved in the space program in some way.
Yes, and I really think that the education and the opportunities to have hands-on, maybe apprenticeships with people that are going to be getting trained, because it takes a while for people to be readied to enter into an adventure of life. It's going to take them into outer space. And I know I've talked to a number of people that said, I'm ready. If I had $5 million, I'd pick for the next flight, you know, to Mars. It's fascinating what is evolving so quickly in today's world. Now, Richard, you have a website, and it's your name, richardandersonauthor.com. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right, richardandersonauthor.com, and that's A-N-D-E-R-S-O-N. And I will say that both of the books are extraordinarily fascinating. But, boy, I really enjoyed Outbound, Islands in the Void. I just think that your concepts, all of the different little points that we touched on, and so much more, including a super conspiracy that creates all kinds of challenges, it is really a fascinating read. It really, really is. And your next book is coming out when?
Well, I was targeting May. It may be June. It depends on the editing. You know, like I say, I expect it back from the copy editor in about a week, and then it depends on how much work needs to be done cleaning up some of the book. And there's a few things I need to correct in it. So it's going to come out this spring.
Well, it has some wonderful,
Outbound Meta Mars, and what it is they're working to cover in the book they're working to cover Valles Marineris, which is a Grand Canyon like rift, only 20 times bigger, deeper and wider, and about 4,000 kilometers long across the equator of Mars. And they're working to cover that and to develop an environment, seal it off, an environment underneath where they can develop cities, orchards, trees, lakes, you know, the whole works, the whole place to live on Mars, underground, but with the Earth atmosphere. And then I developed something called Twirl Towers.
We don't need to go into that yet. You need to send me the book, and then we'll talk about it. Okay?
That's true.
Okay.
That's true.
All right, so you've got to send me the next one so we can continue our outer space travels.
Oh, yeah, we will.
I want to thank you for being my guest.
I'm starting the next book, which is A Return to Earth, and we won't talk about that.
Yeah, let's just hold off on that. Yeah, that's fine. We'll talk again, Richard. You just need to make sure you send me the new one when it comes out.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you for being my guest this evening.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a lot of fun.
I'm glad. You take care now. We're ready for another trip as soon as we get your next book.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. You know, you get into the space travel, and before you know it, you're way out there in outer space. We're going to be right back. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio, able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to Mrs. Sebo's Classics. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on the Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Well, now we're coming back down to earth. I wanted to let you know tomorrow you will be able to have access to my newsletter. And my goodness, my schedule has been so busy that I'm later than usual trying to get everything ready and put out there. But it will be sent out, so it's in your email box if you are a subscriber. It will be there tomorrow, so we'll have that. Also, for those of you who are authors, and or if you have an organization that you would like to feature on one of my upcoming television shows, we've got our first one done, and that is going to be available on YouTube shortly. We found that there was a misprint of information, so we are having to wait a little bit longer before we put it up on YouTube, but it is an author's legacy. So that is the first show of 2025. And don't forget the author's showcase. But if you want to be on the television show, and also in addition be on the radio show, then what I would say is contact me through my website, which is DelphiInternational.com. Just Google my name, Donna Sebo, S-E-E-B-O, and it will automatically connect you to the website, also to the network page, and you will have access to that contact page, and just send me an email, and I'll be sure to send you the protocols on becoming a guest on the television show. So I wanted to let you know about that because we're setting up for another studio filming this month and also for the month of May. So I wanted to give you a heads up on that. And my goodness, we are going to be April 1st tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Alicia West about Tipsy. Now, this has to do with women and alcohol. Now, the physiology of a female frequently has a challenge with alcohol that may seem similar to a male, but the physiology of a female responds in a different way to alcohol. And so Alicia brings that out. Also, we're going to be talking with Mike Cobb, and this is quite a read. You will know me by my deeds, and then your 7 words to a happier you with Jerry Giordano, and the law of zero with Michael Hardy. And we have so much more. And in the newsletter, the authors, along with the titles of their books, will be featured. And if you want to stay up to date with everything that's happening, then you can go and you can read the newsletter right on my website. And if you should decide you'd like to become a subscriber, you have a chance to sign up as well. Now, the very first program with Warriors for Peace is going to be The Countess and the Nazis. Now, this is a true story, and it is absolutely fascinating because it is about an American woman who marries into the aristocracy in Europe, and consequently, the situations that evolve are with the ending of the First World War and then the evolution into the Second World War, what she sees and how she was able to become, in the minds of just about everybody who crossed her path, the heroine that she really, really is. And I'll use the present tense in that because the truth is that her character, her integrity, her intelligence, all of that was it's just an incredible story. So we're going to be talking about that and how that research came about and so much more. Anyway, there you go. And I want you to know the phone line is open if you wanted to give me a call. Hey, I have got a chocolate nut pie. You know, in April, we're going to be celebrating Easter and people are going to be getting together and they're going to be having all kinds of fabulous food. Easter was one of the biggest holidays for eating out for a lot of people. Now, with COVID, that disappeared. And I think that what many people have found is they really like having the fellowship of family and friends around on Easter. But I do think the restaurants are going to be nicely busy, which is great for them. But this is a pie that you could serve just about any time. And it is very, very easy to make. And if you're a lazy cook like me, you probably will use a pie shell from the grocery store or get one that's already frozen and then you can let it thaw and fit it into, you know, a pie pan. But this is really, really easy and it is so delicious. Chocolate and pecans go together beautifully. If you don't like pecans, you can do walnuts. You might even want to try macadamia nuts and almonds. I mean, this can be used with just about any nut. And this is what the recipe is. You need a half of a package, and the package is usually about 10 to 11 ounces, of pastry mix if you're going to make it, or you can make your own homemade pie crust. And you need, if you're going to make tarts, this could be workable to make tarts with. You can always get the pastry for tarts. But I know a friend of mine, she went and fixed the most delicious quiche, and I asked her if she had made the crust, and she said, no, I don't have time for that. And she had bought a store-ready crust, and it was just delicious. It really was quite good. So whether you make your own crust, you're going to need to have a pastry for a single crust pie. Very important. You only need the one crust. And you want to have a 9-inch pie plate. So your pie crust, whether you fix your own or you buy one from the store, you want to crimp the edges so that it looks pretty after, you know, as it's baking. And you are going to find that when it comes time to cook the pie, you want your oven preheated to 400 degrees. Now the filling, simple, simple. Let me give you the ingredients for the filling. You're going to need 3 eggs, room temperature, by the way, 1 cup of light corn syrup. I don't use corn syrup. I use maple syrup. Yes, it's just as good, just as good. All right, so you have that. 1/8 of a teaspoon of salt, 1 teaspoon of vanilla extract, 1 cup of light brown sugar packed to measure, 2 tablespoons of butter, and it needs to be melted, 2 squares of unsweetened chocolate, that's about 2 ounces worth, melted, and then 1 cup of pecan or walnut halves. And then you want 1/2 cup of whipped cream because that is something that you'll have to complement the pie. So it's not going to go in the ingredients of the pie filling. Okay, so this is how simple it is. Your pie filling, you use a medium-sized bowl, and you're going to beat the eggs slightly. Then you want to add your corn syrup, or if you're like me, you use maple syrup, salt, vanilla, brown sugar, and butter. Mix it all together. Then you stir in the melted chocolate, and you're going to fold in the nuts, and you pour the filling into the pie shell. That's how simple this is. Now, your oven should be preheated to 400 degrees, and then you're going to put your pie on the center rack in the oven, bake it for 15 minutes, reduce the oven temperature to 350 degrees, and bake it for 30 to 35 minutes longer, or until the edge of the outer edge of your filling seems like it's set. And then you're going to remove it from the oven and you let it cool. Voila! That's all there is to it. It is so simple and easy. Now, the whipped cream, in the SIBO house, we like the vanilla bean ice cream with this rather than the whipped cream. But some people love whipped cream, so you could use that as a topping and let people, you know, serve themselves, whether they like whipped cream or don't like whipped cream. But it's a wonderful compliment. It's a wonderful compliment to this. It's a pecan pie. And it is just absolutely wonderful. But like I said, you can substitute other nuts. You can check on walnuts, macadamias. You could use almonds. But the pecan especially is very, very good with this. And that makes about, depending on the size, 6 to 8 servings. I'd probably say 6 servings because people really like it. And it's great with coffee or tea, and it looks so pretty. Now, if you really wanted to get fancy with this, after the pie totally cools, you then could put, you know, because you've got the fluted edge of the pie crust itself, you could actually, if you wanted to, pipe in whipped cream around the inside edge of the pie. And it makes a beautiful presentation. Absolutely beautiful. And it is so good. So easy and so good. So I wanted to share that with you because that is something when I've fixed pecan pies, I don't fix them very often because they're so good that I feel I'd end up looking like one, you know, boom, that I don't need. But, oh, I just really, really think that the flavors are great. And the reason I use maple syrup instead of corn syrup is that the maple syrup gives a different flavor. And I really, really like it. And my guests have always liked it, too. You know, we were talking about outer space and the space travel publication, Outbound Islands in the Void. And there is something that came across my desk, and I just shook my head. I said, oh, my goodness, who finds out this stuff? This is actually true, and it came from Atlas Obscura. I have never heard of that publication, but by golly, this is what they found out, and this is what I found that they stated. Gravity is a lot less uniform than you think. Areas with denser rock types, such as your mountains, have stronger gravity than those with less dense types. And you think of ocean trenches. And along with this is this very, very significant commentary. You would be slightly lighter or heavier in different parts of the world. The same person would weigh a little more in southern Illinois, for instance, than in neighboring Indiana. I wonder how they figured that out. Fascinating stuff. There's all of these intriguing details about the Earth that I just think are totally, totally amazing. And speaking of that, one of the critters on this planet that are so fascinating, it has long been said that the aerodynamics of their body structure, they shouldn't be able to fly. And that is the bee, yes. And I know in my backyard, there are these blue-purple kind of color-toned flowers. They're wild. I have no idea what species they are. And they'll take over areas. They like the soil in a certain area in my backyard, and the bees love those flowers. So I just decided, instead of pulling them up like you try to do with weeds, I said, oh, the heck with it. I'm not going to work that hard. And by golly, we have all kinds of different bee species that go into those plants, and they're going after the nectar. It's absolutely fascinating to watch them. And those bluish-purple flowers have something that they really like, and they take it back to their hives. So sometimes you just need to let nature put that which is going to grow into the soil that you have. Just let it be and see what happens, see what comes up. Bees are amazing, not just because the aerodynamics of their structure, which is, according to science, not supposed to work, but it does. They also have an incredible sense of smell. They can detect odors in parts per trillion. And the example that was given to help you to imagine what that would mean is a grain of salt in an Olympic-sized swimming pool. Do you know that they are using bees to locate landmines? In the Balkans in the 1990s with the Yugoslav War, there are hundreds of these mines. They actually trained the bees to associate with the scent of explosives with a sugar solution. And then they release them in the field, and the bees will cluster where the mines are buried. And, of course, they're so tiny, they don't trigger the mines. And the people that are searching for the mines find them. and get them out of the way. Absolutely fascinating. I did not know they were doing that with bees. And then something can affect planes. Again, those little tiny critter, the bees. And if you have ever seen a swarm, have you ever seen a swarm of bees? I have. It was a fascinating, fascinating happening. I was with a fellow that I was dating at the time, and we were en route to a certain destination, and he noticed, because he likes to raise bees, he noticed this massive dark cloud, and he said, I wonder if that's a bunch of bees. And I looked at it, and I thought, I have no idea what it is. And sure enough, it was moving very quickly, but it was very dense, this black cloud. And sure enough, it was bees. And what they did, they went over to a fence, and they covered this fence. It was like a wire metal fence. And actually, we discovered it was two gates that they ended up covering. So their queen was migrating, and they were following her. And we sat and we watched it, and he called in to a particular phone number. I don't remember the name of the organization, but they will come out. There are different groups that if you report a bee swarm, they actually will come out and collect the swarm because they don't want people to be hurt. They sometimes will congregate into areas that are not, you know, not good areas for them to be in. And so they will capture them, and then they will release them into an area where they can find a new location to swarm into to build their hives. And it really was quite an experience. So this information regarding the bees that crossed my desk, I thought I would share them with you, the different points of information, because you never know. If you like being out in the woods or you are out in environments like, say, farms, sometimes there are swarms of bees that will be out in agricultural areas, and they move, and they, for whatever reason, and you may have an experience like that. And once you have an experience like that, you never, ever forget it. Believe me, it is fascinating. Donna Sebo here. I know we're just about out of time, and I want to thank you for being with me. I hope you have had an absolutely fabulous past weekend here, and we're coming into April, and before we know it, the Easter Bunny is going to be sharing its presence with us, and by golly, the Easter decorations are out in abundance, absolutely, and of course, we don't run out of chocolate after the holidays. Mm-mm. Between Valentine's Day and Easter, and my goodness, the holidays keep flowing with that wonderful stuff that so many of us enjoy. And if you've got a sweet tooth, it really is satisfying, isn't it? Donna Sebo here. Remember always that you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You are the person that is in charge of your attitudes. You are in charge of your perceptions, your beliefs, your biases. All of that is under your dominion. You may not be able to do anything about anybody else, but you are the one that makes the choices in your life. And so when we can become aware of that which we don't want in our life, and we focus on that which we do want in our life, and we take those particular levels of ourselves and grow up into the best we can be, my goodness, miracles happen in absolutely wonderful, wonderful waves. And I'm so glad you've joined me. And that newsletter, well, we've got a lot of good things that we're sharing in it. Most of all, it's just staying in touch and sharing good positive thoughts along with, I think, a pretty nice recipe or two, as well as information on other things, too. Take care, God bless, and I'll be with you tomorrow evening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.